This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Tuesday. Matt Patrick here. Unfortunately, I got to lead with a story here. Breaking news, at least 14 students and a teacher are killed in a mass shooting in an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas. U-V-A-L-D-E, Texas. This is the latest story. Once again, 14 students and a teacher at an elementary school that were killed in the shooting at the school, Robb Elementary School in Texas. A hastily called press conference, Averett said the shooter, 18-year-old Salvador Ramos of Uvalde, abandoned his vehicle, entered into the school with a handgun and possibly a rifle, opened fire, killing 14. Obviously, this is just a breaking story as we are reading it. So obviously, we'll keep an update on this, and as more news comes out on this tragic story out of Texas, we'll cover more of that. Once again, 14 dead and 14 students and a teacher dead in a mass shooting in an elementary school in Texas. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We talked yesterday extensively about what happened at the end of the session. A lot of bills didn't get passed, but one that did get passed was the ag bill. And joining us right now, our Democrat of the day, Representative Mike Sundin, is District 11A, which if you've ever driven north, you've gone through his district. You've gone to Duluth, you've gone through his district. Moose Lake, Barnum, Cloquet, heading right up to the Duluth border. Good chunk of 33. I think the Fond du Lac Reservation is in that as well. This is the old district. He has decided not to run. We'll talk about that here in just a little bit. But he's kind enough today to join us and talk about the ag bill that did pass. Representative, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to tell you about the bill that did pass. It's got several components to it. You know, it was like a three-ring circus for me acting as chair. They assigned housing and agriculture and broadband all in the same committee. But we ended up producing the bill. We separated the bill when it got to me, and I passed the housing off to Alice Hausman. She's the pro there, and she's still working on that bill. Hopefully, she can get that one across the line as well. But we ended up with a drought relief bill that we added the agriculture stuff to, and then at the end, we got the broadband in, too. So I'd like to talk about all three of those if we have time.
By all means. No, this is why I'm having you on the air, because this is a good bill, and it is a great example of what we used to call a bipartisan bill, although we'll talk about the House Republicans in a second here. But it was a good bill, and I'm very glad, by the way, with the broadband, you kept that in with that bill, because that is just as much an ag bill issue as anything else. But let's start with the drought relief. Republicans in the Senate were threatening to, as Kurt Daut explained, execute commissioners, which led to drought relief being put off because Republicans would not vow to that they wouldn't do that if there was a special session. We finally did get that drought relief. Talk about that. That has been well needed, and it's been needed for a while at this point.
Certainly. Last summer's drought was devastating for many industries, the ag most particularly. Some of the farmers, the crop farmers, the cattle producers, and also the small, I guess we can call them cottage farmers, the farmers markets, they all took a beating on this, and hopefully we can make them whole and get them back on their feet with this bill.
And it's kind of weird now because of the amount of rain and snow we've had in basically the last 3 months. But this was, you saw it on the lakes, you saw it everywhere. The water levels were exceptionally low across the state. And when you're looking at crops, obviously, and I've lived in rural Iowa, you see this all the time, you know, it becomes a war of attrition. What can you save? How much money can you spend on getting water on those crops? I mean, a lot of farmers went through a real tough time for quite a while there with that drought.
They did. I'll give you some numbers as far as where the money was spent, you know, in the agreement on drought, most particularly, let me get the numbers straight on this. Okay. Geez, that's the entire bill right there. The drought bill was started off with ag and the natural resources appropriations as well. But the Republicans were not going to take the natural resources language. I just don't know exactly what their thought process was. You know, a drought affects every aspect of nature, and they just were not going to bite on it. But the drought relief package started off with $10 million for ag and $13 million for DNR purposes, and they just would not take it. They would not even talk about the DNR. And I had a particular interest in this because of the seedlings and the saplings produced for reforestation processes, you know. We had tree seedling replacement at $5 million, and we also had some resolving well interferences for like $300,000, and they just would not talk about it. But because the ag groups thought it was unfair to have more money going into the DNR stuff rather than the ag stuff. So and during the course of negotiations, we said, okay, well, we'll take 13.5 or 13.1 or whatever it was, and we'll put that in the ag, and we'll cut the DNR stuff short. And so they agreed to switch the numbers, but then they still wouldn't agree to the DNR language. So at the end of the day, when some of the higher powers, leadership, and the governor's office got involved, we got another $5 million freed up, and that went for the tree seedling replacement. And that extra $3 million stuck with the ag purposes. So we kind of fell into the good luck on that one, but. Mm-hmm. I can give you the rundown if you want on the drought grant appropriations.
Well, that's okay, but I mean, we don't necessarily need to get into that because we got a lot of things we do got to get into this bill because it's a very, like I said, very good bill. But it was once again, you know, and Governor Walz and the leaderships and that were there, they got involved there. So the DNR did get its drought funding as well.
Well, they got a good portion of it. They got $5 million for the seedling replacements, and that, you know, that's scattered out through the DNR managed lands and pass through grants to assist tribal entities, county entities for reforestation purposes. It all went to a good place there, but it's some of those seedlings. There's 100% kill off in some of those nurseries, and that's just you can't have that. You know, we rely on the forestry industry up in the northern part of the state. And you have to plant trees. You cut a tree down, you should plant two.
That's actually kind of the concept, and that's effective management of the woodlands. That's for sure. Let's go back to the farming issues here. The grants that were opened up. I mean, margins for farmers today are just obnoxious. There are some very large farms that do very well, but when you're talking about the average farm, you're talking about the I like to call them boutique farms. A lot of the guys that grow the stuff that shows up at farmers markets, their margins are really tough right now. Talk about some of the benefits that they got out of the ag bill for them.
Oh boy, they came out winners too, and I've got to give a lot of credit to Vice Chair Vang. She's been a terrific partner. Yes. She's up in the northern suburbs there too, you know, and she's just an excellent partner. You know, I'll go through some of the points of the bill actually. You know, that we touched on. You know, we had livestock investment grants. You know, to help through the livestock producers come through. We had farm down payment assistance grants. That's a really good one for the small farmers coming through, you know, and trying to break in and trying to find some land and trying to afford support their habit of farming, put it that way, you know. But we did get extension on the dedicated pollinator habitat and research account. We didn't get any cash there, but you know, we kept that account alive, so we can get into it there as well. So we did put some money into the ACRA program, that's the Ag Chemical Response and Reimbursement Account. You know, the floor amount's about $2 million, and the new ceiling is about $6.5 million. So that bill raises the max amount to $550,000 from the current $350,000. So if there's a chemical spill or a problem with farm chemicals, that type of thing, you know, we can take care of them. We can clean it up. So, but we've got the Board of Animal Health. We had some provisions in there that allow the Board of Animal Health to apply for, reserve, and receive and disperse federal funds. You know, a lot of money comes through from the USDA, and we have to authorize the different divisions so they can spend that money and do their thing. We've got some language changes in the bioincentive program. That's a favorite of mine, and I'll tell you why. Up in my district, we've got a paper plant, mm-hmm. and they're very diverse products come out of there, not just coated paper. They've got a wafer board, a wafer product that actually gets shipped over to China or over to Europe, wherever, and it'll come back as clothing products, medical products, that type of thing, mm. and it's great. But anyway, they're looking at a sweetener. It's not they call it the sugar project, but it's not a sugar. It's a sweetener that's derived from the residue from the paper making process, straight from the wood. It's refined that sap that's derived, and it's a non-diabetic, non-diabetic reactive sweetener.
How in the heck have I never heard about this? This is amazing. It makes sense. I mean, obviously, tree sap on maples is made into syrup and stuff. So clearly, there's a sweetener capacity there. This sounds fantastic. When did they start realizing this potential?
Okay, that's an emerging market. It's being produced in Canada. It's being produced in South Africa. And hopefully, we can get it up in Cloquet, Minnesota. And we've got some of the incentive grants, okay? No, those companies don't get a penny until they produce something, you know. And this is the incentive, okay? If you're serious about your project, we can feed you a little bit of money to help make the process or promise that you're going to produce something. So this is great. It's non-diabetic reactive. This is terrific. I can't name the companies. I won't name the companies that are interested in it, but they definitely want it.
And by the way, joining us once again right now, Democrat of the day is Representative Mike Sundin, District 11A. He got through this ag bill here. Two other things about the ag bill I want to touch on before I give you a chance to talk about your career there, because you are retiring after this session. First of all, let's talk a little bit about the University of Minnesota scientists. We got chronic wasting disease. We got bird flu going through here. Clearly, and there you go. You have two different diseases, one affecting the wild population and a limited amount of the of the farmed population of deer. But then you have the bird population, which is obviously very, you know, we want to make sure that stays safe. Talk about getting some help to the U of M to help diagnose these health issues.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm going to just depend on my memory right now, but I think there's about $4.5 million into further research, you know, for animal disease, or actually response to the animal disease. You know, when you have the flu outbreak on these poultry farms, it's just disaster. You know, you have to euthanize those animals. You have to compost them, and they have to clean those barns. Commissioner Tom Peterson has done just a terrific job planning for the next disasters, you know, and they're on top of it. But you know, the university has to be prepared. The administration has to be prepared to react. So we get allocated some money there to help them out, and then the diagnostic labs as well. They've got. Gosh, I can't remember all the numbers, but $1.5 million or whatever to help with the facilities there. And it's not just the avian influenza. You know, we're looking at the threat of a swine flu as well.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of these threats out there. But back to the chronic wasting disease with the deer, it's I'm just passionate about curtailing any further permitting or of deer farms until we get a handle on this chronic wasting disease. Mm-hmm. I'm a hunter. I love hunting white-tailed deer. I love hunting elk, and I'd like to see the expansion of elk. I'd like to see all those species returned, to the Minnesota settings. But we have to do it carefully. We have to do it right. And if the servant farmers can't be held responsible, doggone it, we got to shut them down.
Yeah.
That said, there's the other side of the coin, and you have to realize these people have a lot of money invested into these farms, and some of them are doing it just perfectly. They're doing it right. But if we're going to, I think the first step is no more permitting of new farms. Crack down on the transportation back and forth of the animals that do exist. And then eventually some kind of a buyout program, yeah. Because I understand the fairness issue here where they've got all this money invested and we're just going to shut them down. That's pretty unfair to them. They've got so much money invested. But, we can figure it out. We've got a lot of smart people working in St. Paul.
Yeah. Rick Hansen's been on the air. We've had Jamie Becker Finn on this issue as well. And as well, too, we don't want to have what happened in Ohio where they had to shut down the deer hunting season. You don't want to have something like that happen. You don't want to have that happen. I mean, in Minnesota, the economic impact of that alone 1 year would wipe out a lot of communities. And so you can't have that. Let's get to broadband. I am very glad you guys put the broadband in there. This is the first broadband bill I have said, nicely done. You're getting it done there. It is. It's got money. It's going to be able to expand this out here. Talk a little bit about that, because as we're talking about farmers, I think in the last 2 years, whether it's education, whether it's medical, whether it's opportunity for economic expansion, or just quality of life in rural Minnesota, broadband has to be out there for our farmers.
I totally agree. If you drive by a farm and see what's going on nowadays compared to 40 or 50 years ago when I grew up on the farm, it's such a change. It's unbelievable. You got drones flying over. You've got thermal imaging, so you can regulate how much irrigation you need. It's just terrific. But the communication is critical too. Just a kind of a funny story on the broadband issue. Our local expert or legislative expert on the DFL side is Representative Rob Eklund, who I actually went to high school with. He attended my first wedding. Heck of a guy, smart, hardworking legislator, and he's actually my roommate down there, so in St. Paul. A terrific guy. He carried the broadband bill, and hey, let's stick it in there. You bet. So it's $25 million this year, $25 million the next. And there's it captures a lot of the federal money that's coming through. So when it's all said and done, we're north of $200 million in one bill that will affect rural Minnesota and some of the metro area as well. The broadband service is okay, but some of the facilities, let's say a library or a community center, they need some infrastructure there. The money be available for some of that too. So it's going to be spread out correctly. And like I say, $25 million this year, $25 million next year, and then the federal money on top of that. We lost the construction season last year because we didn't get the money out for broadband, and that was wrong. That was dead wrong.
The one of the things that too I want to point out is that this bill got through. It got through in the Senate with bipartisan support up there. It got through in the House with only the DFL voting for it. The House Republicans, who kept once again saying we need a drought relief, we need farmer relief, we need a broadband. Once again, when it came time to fish or cut bait, they decided to go back and cut more bait. And they're going to try to take credit for it. But this is your bill. The House Republicans completely and totally voted against this. And that is just unacceptable.
They hold their caucus tight. And you are simply not allowed to vote against the wishes of the leadership. Yeah. That's bad. It's bad for democracy. I know some of my friends on the Republican side that really complimented me on the bill, but, you know, when their leadership says jump, they jump. That's unfortunate.
You know, when the one of the things that I want to point out here, too, and I mean, first of all, nice job on the Ag Bill. Ag Bill did great.
Thank you.
I'm very glad about this. I'm a big ag guy, and I've lived in rural Minnesota, and I've lived in rural America, and I can see the benefits we need to put it out there. And I think there's so much common sense, good things in this bill. It's really kind of nice to see that it got some bipartisan support up in the Senate. But I just want to also take a moment here to mention that you have decided you're not going to run again for what would, I don't know if it'd be 11A or what the new redistricted district is. Talk a little bit, why did you decide not to run again?
Well, I have the rest of my life to live here, you know, and I'm 65 years old this year. I've got more yesterdays than tomorrows. I've got a wife. I finally got a wife I get along with. She's terrific. And also, we're going to take advantage of that. I've got the family that lives out of state, and I've got the family farm up in Cochin County. I still love going up there. I've got a nice spot tilled up. I'm going to grow a quarter mile of potatoes, and that'll be about 1,000 pounds of potatoes.
Nice.
And yeah, I'm going to give them away. I can't eat that many potatoes.
And,
you know, I walked into one of the local watering holes last year, and I, you know, gave a few bags of potatoes away to this, you know, a few people. And one fellow says, "I'll take one." Great. So I walked in there another time, and he said, "Hey, you got any more potatoes?" You know, this is a guy, I don't know, I didn't even like the guy too much, you know, but he appreciated fresh potatoes. I said, "You know something, buddy? You'll get them every time I dig." So, you know, it's fun to see people enjoy the, you know, fruits of your labor.
If you have an extra bag of potatoes, I'm sure we here at the radio station would love to have one of those. If you have those,
send me your address. It may happen.
I'll be driving up into your community. I'll be driving by your district. I might not be up in Cochin, but I might be in your district. I'll definitely swing on by. Last thing, if I can ask you, Representative, if you had one thing, this ag bill was exceptional. What was your favorite thing, the one thing that you feel most proud about getting passed and working on while you were in the House?
I'm going to say two.
Okay.
I'm going to give you two. One, when I was on the labor committee, I didn't, you know, I was new, and the railroad lobby came in and they said, "Yeah, here's a good bill, Mike." You know, by the time I presented it in three different committees, I realized what I was doing. And it was a labor bill to ensure that all the employees, construction, maintenance, cleaning, engineers, everybody that worked on those the light rail down there would receive benefits prescribed by the federal railroad bill. So if you think about that, now those tracks are going to be in service for maybe 100 years, and I don't know how many thousands of people are going to be working there over the course of the next 100 years. But there's going to be tens of thousands, if not 100,000 or north of that, of families that are going to have medical coverage. They're going to have a decent wage, a decent retirement as well. So I feel really thrilled about being a part of that. That's number one. Number two is I get all choked up. Mm-hmm. It's a family called about 2 years ago at the beginning of the pandemic, and they said, "Our little girl was just diagnosed with a defect in her ear. She was deaf, her hearing. She needed an operation, and the hospitals were closing down."
Mm-hmm.
And they were just worried sick because there's only a certain window where they can do this operation, you know, as far as the age of the kid. And what can we do? I says, "Let me make a call." So I've got connections at Essentia Health up here. Another fellow from International Falls. I'm not going to name his name. But anyway, I threw an elbow in. They got a call the next day. "Get that kid in here." We didn't realize what was going on. She got the operation. They got a kid. Little girl can hear. She, you know, years from now, she might be my cardiologist. She might be a school teacher. She might be just a darn good mother. But I feel good.
You're a good man, Mike Sundin. You are a good man. Nicely done. You will be missed in St. Paul. I don't get me wrong. Potato farming actually sounds quite delightful. You know, you enjoy your time and you go out there and enjoy what you're going to do. But well done on a lot of things. Exceptional work on this ag bill. Exceptional work while you've been in St. Paul. Thank you very much. I do appreciate the time, and thanks for all you've done for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you so much. Don't be afraid to call me 1st of October or so for potatoes.
Oh, I'll be in touch on that one. Representative Mike Sundin, DFL District 11A, Democrat of the day. What an amazing story there at the end. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. First of all, thanks Representative Mike Sundin for joining us. I had that interview set up before the news of the day. Reading from the New York Times, a gunman walked into an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas on Tuesday afternoon, killing 14 children and the teacher. Governor Greg Abbott said in a news conference, police officers are believed to have also killed the gunman. The assailant was an 18-year-old man who abandoned his vehicle and entered the school with a handgun and possibly a rifle. He shot and killed horrifically, incomprehensibly, 14 students and killed a teacher, said Mr. Abbott. I got to believe that unless he had a modified handgun, that, you know, he probably had some other weapon too, because the handguns generally don't have a lot of rounds in them. You know, they have some. And so unless he reloaded. At a news conference on Tuesday afternoon, Pete Arredondo, the police chief of Uvalde Consolidated Independent School District, said the several adults and students had been injured. The school has students in the second through the fourth grades, he said. At this point, the investigation is leading to tell us the suspect did act alone during his heinous crime. Two children who were killed were died by the time they arrived in Uvalde Memorial Hospital, said Adam Alpinar, the hospital's chief operating officer. Earlier in the afternoon, their ages were not immediately released. Uvalde is a city of about 16,000 people, about 84 miles west of San Antonio. In an earlier update, the hospital said several students were from the school, Robb Elementary, and are being treated in the emergency room. Another hospital, University Health in San Antonio, said that it had received two patients, a child and an adult, from the shooting. The adult is a 66-year-old woman, the child a 10-year-old girl, who are in critical condition, the hospital has said in an update. Uvalde Consolidated Independent School District said on Tuesday there was an active shooter on the rounds there. Another day, a different state. 10. Right now, do you want to know how sick our country is? Right now, there are people whose first concern is to make sure the guns are not looked upon in a bad light. Hey, after this school shooting of 10-year-olds, people are going to be saying guns are bad. We need a game plan to make sure that people know this is going to be safe. The guns are safe. Republicans don't care. They only get the money. They're already imagining the conspiracy theory. Because these shootings of children are so horrific that they themselves have to admit, sweet Jesus, we have to do something about the guns. So what they do is they'll create a false flag operation. It didn't really happen, because if it really happened and I was still here pushing guns, I'd be a really horrible human being. So I've just determined that the gun shooting didn't happen. You're already going to get people out there who are going to be saying, well, see, the real problem here is you're not arming the teachers. It's freaking Texas. They are already armed. March 7th, 2022, from the New York Post. Some teachers in a tiny district in Texas are now packing heat, and educators won't hesitate to take out an armed student. Bull! You guys suck at this. That is not making you safer. Texas governor signs more bills allowing more armed teachers. Where are they? This is supposed to be the big solution. You can't ban guns, so we're going to just arm every... Oh, they suck. They suck at stopping this. More guns do not make you safer. They don't. If you have to create a zombie apocalypse situation to justify your armament of the society that you live in, you have failed. No! The founding fathers wouldn't look down in Texas and say, well, that's unfortunate, but that's exactly what we wanted to have happen in this country. Nope. Not even close. And yet, we already know that no Republican will do a damn thing to save these lives that they so claim to cherish. We cherish the lives. We're going to make sure nobody gets an abortion so those children can be gunned down at 10 years old in a freaking elementary school. Because that is America. That, in this twisted, broken, conservative nightmare that we are living in, that is America. Make sure the kid gets born so that they can get gunned down in an elementary school. Just go fix this. You are the politicians. You could fix this. We made alcohol illegal, and then we went and changed it. That's what the Constitution is for. You can fix this tomorrow. And you won't, because that sweet, sweet money you get from the gun manufacturers and the bullet manufacturers will prevent you from doing a damn thing. You're perfectly fine with 10-year-olds getting gunned down in the streets, in their classrooms, for God's sakes. Because you're not going to do a damn thing to stop it. And you've tried. Oh, we're going to give guns to every... We'll give guns to every teacher. We'll give guns to every... Oh, guns everywhere. We need to arm the students. We need to... Remember when the Newtown happened? What was the argument? Oh, we're going to give them bulletproof whiteboards that they can whip around like freaking Captain America to stop seven-year-olds to stop a mad gunman from killing them. The insanity of this country is that in Buffalo, Minnesota, we had, and by the way, and isn't it tragic? I have to clarify which shooting we're talking about. Buffalo, not New York's Buffalo shooting. No, the one that happened at the hospital in Buffalo, Minnesota, where the guy was mentally compromised, had a record, should not have been able to get a gun, and the Wright County Sheriff basically said, I can't stop him. Republicans wrote these laws. I can't stop him. I got to arm them to the hilt. We got to allow them to do it. Ten. And they're already going to do nothing. They slaughter people in Buffalo, New York. They did nothing. They slaughter people in Las Vegas, Nevada. They do nothing. They slaughter people at a school in Florida. They do nothing. They slaughter people at a school in Connecticut. And they do nothing because their argument is this is what the founding fathers wanted. They were so pro-gun, even though the gun says right to bear arms as part of a well-regulated militia. It doesn't talk about psychopaths arming themselves like a third world country and slaughtering innocent children in a school. They think that the founding fathers would look at this and say, it's unfortunate, but this is exactly what, you know, they killed a bunch of kids. Well, that's a shame, but, you know, this is what we wanted. Right now, right now, there is a shocking amount of people, and their first argument is not the kids. It's how do we make sure the guns don't get a bad rep here? Come on. Come on. You know, it's, you know, we should arm the teachers. Oh, the teachers were already armed. Oh, all right. Mental health. We need to deal more about mental health, but we're not going to put any money into mental health, and we're sure as hell not going to create a database to prevent people who are mentally compromised from getting weapons. No, God, we want those sales on the books. Cha-ching! And right now, there are people trying to find out what guns this guy used so they can run down to their local gun store and buy them. So I guess they can have their buddies as they drink in the backyard saying, see that pistol right there? That's the same pistol that gunned down some children down in Texas. How about that? You want to feel it? Sweet Jesus, no, you demented, broken freak. What the hell's wrong with you? Fourteen dead kids. And we don't know how many injured. A town of 16,000, every person in that town just got affected by gun violence. Every human being there. Guns have done more to damage the American people than anything else. I'd make an even argument that that's done more than drugs, hard drugs. The carnage on our streets on a daily basis is astronomical. And yet we do nothing. We do nothing. Because the Republicans, well, they'll come on out and say, we cherish life. Oh, wait, that's the argument I use when it's abortion. Oh, well, we cherish guns. Slippery slope, Matt. If we stop psychopaths from getting guns and slaughtering children, slippery slope. Wow. Oh. 10. Girl's 10 years old. 10. What are we doing here as a country? How did we get to a point where we care so little about everyone else? I do the coronavirus update, and we have people screaming about, never wear a mask, I'm never getting vaccinated. And I brought up yesterday, we talked extensively yesterday about how because Republicans politicize vaccines and masks, a 2-to-1 ratio of deaths happened in Republican districts. 2-to-1. They killed off their own people. And what did I say yesterday? What did I say yesterday? Those same people will still go vote for them. So, you know, sure, they killed grandma and they killed the neighbor, but, you know, I'm voting GOP all the way. I don't know. I don't know. I just don't know what can happen. And I said after Newtown, I said, my God, what will it take for us to realize that guns are not the solution? And I came up with probably, and I'm still torn on whether or not anything would ever get done, is if a bunch of people who are with criminal records, clearly mentally compromised, in and out of mental facilities, were able to go get a bunch of assault weapons and walk into a large convention center and gun down like 200 kids. Like 200 kids wearing body armor and all this stuff. And they would do that. Would that finally be enough for some people to say, oh, wow. And then Vegas happened. And they didn't even bat an eye. Nope. 50-something dead? No, we're not going to do a dang thing. See, is this what they think America's supposed to be? Because they're sure not doing any damn thing to stop this, and it only gets worse and worse the more you pour guns into the society. Nope, the Republicans right now are worrying about how can we make sure the guns are not the bad guys in the mass shooting of young children? Or they're saying, well, for me, if I'm still supporting guns after they go and slaughter a bunch of kids, that makes me a horrible human being. So I'm going to just say false flag and presume it was someone just set this up to make guns look bad. See, that I can just deny reality to make my validation. Or they're out there saying, you know who the real problem here was? Why didn't a teacher get out there and John McClane it as they're teaching 10-year-olds art or basic arithmetic? You know, he should have had a gun locked and loaded, safety off, with his hand on the holster the entire time. He should have. See, the real problem here is the teachers are dead. I mean, just let's just be honest about it. Because this is where we're at as America. Force women to give birth to children, even in the cases of rape and incest, just to watch those children that they claim they love, that life, get slaughtered at record rates, courtesy of the gun industry in this country. Just as disturbing. It's just disturbing. And right now, I guarantee you, there are people out there, how dare Matt McNeil point out this yet another shooting happened? You can't talk at all about this at all until we can figure out the narrative that would sell it our side to it. Go to hell. All of you pro-gun freaks, go to hell. When you get to the point when your entire argument is trying to figure out some way to lessen the breaking hearts and internal darkness of young children getting slaughtered at the hands of guns, then you are not worth listening to. You're not worth being around. You're not worth being human. You're just not anymore. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. I'll see if there's any updates when we come back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. New York Times actually has a partial list of mass shootings so far this year. May 24th, Uvalde, Texas. May 14th, Buffalo, New York. May 15th, Laguna Woods, California. May 15th, Houston. May 13th, Milwaukee. April 27th, Biloxi. April 12th, Brooklyn. April 3rd, Sacramento. March 19th, Dumas, Arkansas. 23rd of January in Milwaukee. That is a partial list of mass shootings in this country in the last not even 5 months. Not even 5 months. President Biden will deliver remarks on Texas school shooting on Tuesday evening at 8:15. Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, an advocate for gun control legislation, said, I think everybody here is going to be shaken to the core by this. I have no idea how a community deals with this. There is no way to do this well. Your community is never, ever the same after this. Representative Joaquin Castro of Texas said on Twitter that Uvalde is a wonderful, tight-knit community, and this is a parent's worst nightmare. The chief of the school district's police force, Pete Arredondo, told reporters that the shooting, which he described as a mass casualty event, occurred at 11:32 a.m. We do have some deaths, he said, without specifying how many. The suspect did act alone during this crime, though. Former Representative Beto O'Rourke, a Democrat running for governor, said our broken hearts are with Uvalde. Governor Greg Abbott said in a statement that Texans are grieving for the victims of the senseless crime and for the communities of Uvalde, adding that he and his instructed several agencies to fully investigate this crime. I'm presuming, I'm hoping that he has sent every available mental health expert they've got in the state of Texas to Uvalde. I mean, I'm hoping that, you know, I understand you call out the Texas Rangers, you get to do your photo op where you're tough on crime and you're doing that. I get that. But I'm hoping that you are sending every available mental health professional you've got to Uvalde, Texas. I'm hoping that is on part of your agenda right now. Or is that something, well, that's a private thing, and they want to get that, then they got to pay for that with their private insurance. Anguished parents were instructed by this district to stay away from the school. A message to parents on the district website, please do not pick up students at this time. Students need to be accounted for before they're released to your care. The National Rifle Association's annual meeting is set to be held in Houston on Friday. Former President Donald Trump, Greg Abbott, and Senator Ted Cruz are all among the most getting ready to go out there and talk about how great guns are. Part of me thinks, that will they have the tact to cancel that? No, probably not. Probably get out there with emotional speeches. How dare anybody think a gun is bad? Fourteen dead children and a dead teacher. That's the count as of right now. No word on how many people are injured. The school was supposed to have, district was supposed to have their last day of the school year on Thursday. I remember when Newtown happened. I remember openly weeping as I waited for the school bus to drop off my children who were pretty much the same age as at that time of the Newtown shooting. And I remember my neighbor was out there. She was waiting for her daughter to come off the bus too. And we both just sat there and kind of quietly, I mean, we used to chat every time we saw each other at the bus stop. And I just sat there, and this was in Connecticut. This wasn't in Minneapolis. This wasn't in a neighboring school district. It wasn't even my school district. It was in Connecticut. And I sat there and said, well, at least we now know they're going to start doing something about guns. And here we are, all these years later, all these mass shootings later. And the only thing that's been done about guns is there's more of them. And there are more people who are desperately trying to continue the false narrative that more guns keep you safer. They just don't. They just don't. The good guy with the gun, it just doesn't exist. Guns don't care. They are meant to do something. And when you put them in the hands of a person that wants to do something wrong, they are lethal at it. There should be no reason in the world. Military grade weaponry should be allowed in the hands of anyone in this country outside of the military. And frankly, how in the world we don't have better screening processes at this point, I don't know. Hour two, that's up next. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Brett Johnson joining Patrick and myself today. Brett, some updates here. It's the deadliest Texas school shooting in the country since Newtown, Connecticut, according to Every Town for Gun Safety, a nonprofit that advocates for gun control. The shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary killed 20 first graders and 6 adults. The shooting on Tuesday took place at the elementary school at Uvalde, Texas. Serves more than 500 students who are between 2nd and 4th grades, where the last day of the school year had been scheduled for Thursday. The authorities say that the gunmen killed 14 students and one teacher at the school. Students in 2nd to 4th grades are generally between the ages of 7 and 10. 7 and 10-year-olds. They're thinking about playing Minecraft that night. They're thinking about watching SpongeBob. They're dead. I mean, this is insanity.
The second time in 10 years. I mean, it's just insanity.
Vegas. You know, the Florida shooting, the Newtown, Connecticut, Buffalo, New York. And how about that? When I had to bring up the mass shooting that happened, I had to say Buffalo, Minnesota. Because we had one in Buffalo, Minnesota with the guy shoot up in the hospital there.
You're right.
And then they had the Buffalo, New York. When you actually have got to say, Newtown are we talking about the shooting? Was it this shooting here or was it this shooting across the country here? I'm going to ask you some questions here because as Republicans refuse to deal with banning guns, they have gone overboard at banning other things. So I want you to tell me, I'm going to bring up a thing a Republican has banned. And you tell me how many elementary school kids have been killed by said product, which once again, that they are, this is destroying America. These things are destroying America. So as opposed to dealing with the things that are actually killing children in schools, here are the things that, but books, They've banned books. How many books have killed a student in an elementary school, to your knowledge?
Zero.
All right. Masks.
Zero.
Zero. Transgender athletes.
Zero again.
Yeah. All those things. Republicans are hammering on their podiums about the destruction of America. And the actual destruction of America happens, and they're all of a sudden going to get really quiet because they can't talk bad about the guns.
And they say if liberals ban guns, it's big government. And as you just mentioned, they're banning these things. Oh, that's big government. The difference is one actually kills a whole bunch of people.
Yep.
Guns.
Yep. Yeah. It just, oh. How many times do I have to do this show?
I mean, I do. I mean, seriously. I mean, this is the
tragedy of this whole thing, just the aching of my heart right now of young children as a person who's got three kids.
You have to categorize these things. When I said second in 10 years, that was just the elementary shooting. As you said, I mean, there's so many of these things that you do have to put placeholders on which one it was. Where did it occur? It's nuts.
The state of Texas has armed teachers, and they do it, and they pass this bill, and that teacher will drop that gunman in a heartbeat. Where? When is this happening? It doesn't happen.
Can you even logically think that through? If you're like a math teacher, you're trying to teach your math lesson, you got your gun in your holster ready to go and finger on the trigger ready if someone bursts in? Is that what they really think is happening?
Reminder, when the Newtown shooting happened, Republicans, in their efforts to say, no, we're not going to touch guns, wanted to have teachers basically, as their students walk in, walking like a recon team in the Army Rangers with night goggle visions and everything, is like, get the kids in there and just basically sit there and sweep the room constantly with a loaded armed weapon with the safety off, finger on the trigger. While the kids, remember this? The kids were supposed to have either bulletproof backpacks or whiteboards, which they were going to wield like Captain America and stop the bullets from hitting them. A whiteboard. While at the same time, I remember this in Minnesota, they were all talking about how they wanted security guard gun turrets, bulletproof glass on every window, security doors at every school, and they were all screaming about doing this. And someone looked at them and said, who's going to pay for all this? That's going to be probably $2 to $3 million per every school in the state. Every school, not every school district, but every school within every school district.
Didn't we do a show on this a few years back where I think we ran the math on this on how much it would cost?
Oh, that's right. We did. And it was just in the state of Minnesota. Yeah, we did. We did it for our school district. I think we did for Hopkins School District. We had the high school. We had the two junior highs. We had, I think they got six elementary schools. Are we also looking at like the Spanish immersion school, the Chinese immersion school? And then are we looking at the administration buildings? And we figured it out. It was something like $20 trillion we would have to spend in Minnesota, just in Minnesota, to do what the Republicans said we had to do because we can't touch the guns. They're not going to do a thing. They're not. Let's just be honest. We already know it. They're not going to do a thing.
And that's all they're going to propose in Texas too. We'll just do bulletproof chalkboards.
The real problem here was the teacher that didn't stop them. I don't know what the heck is wrong with you. That's going to be their argument. I mean,
or even more cynically, just conspiracy theories. It didn't happen. That's what they're going to say too.
I already said that. Yeah, for sure. Because they know this. If I'm actually defending guns and guns are being used to slaughter children, well, I'm a horrible human being. So I'll just say, well, the gun slaughter didn't happen, and then we'll just walk away. The NRA convention is in Texas on Friday. I'm going to guess they're going to cancel it. Or maybe they won't, and they'll have it, and they'll be even more belligerent than usual.
I have a feeling that's going to be the case.
And they'll just pull on the leashes of the Republicans and be done with it.
Well, because you had some people who were like, well, the Second Amendment matters more than your kids. That's what they were saying.
And that's what they honestly do believe. They actually think that you do not have their right to take a gun and jam it in your face and say, see, here's my gun, supersedes your right to not have some psychopath stick a gun in your face. They are literally at that point, that the right of the person, that's what they think the founding fathers wanted. The people who run around to everyone else and say, gun, and you got to like it. And you're like, well, don't I have a right to not? have guns constantly waved in my face? I mean, don't you think that should be the default setting of this country? Hey, you don't have to have guns waved in your face. You'd think it'd be.
Just the well-regulated militia, too, that they always forget there.
Bunch of clowns, man. Just a bunch of clowns. And I had some idiot try to argue me. They go, oh, an AR-15 is good for hunting. It's like, no, it's not. An AR-15, you go get a Benelli shotgun. Go get a Benelli rifle. That will be your hunting weapon. That's a hunting weapon. It's designed to hunt with, not slaughter human beings. If it's being used in Ukraine, it's not meant for being used in the duck blind. Dear Lord, these people. Anytime anyone even makes that argument, it just tells me, yeah, you should never have a gun. If you honestly think that an assault weapon should be used to hunt an animal with, you should not have a gun. Ever. I've got one story that's positive, and I'm gonna mention this because this woman does give me a lot of hope, and I've become actually a very big fan of hers. Philanthropist Mackenzie Scott. She has recently donated $6 million to Big Brothers, Big Sisters, Twin Cities, a youth mentoring charity that spans across the nation, part of a total donation of $122.6 million to the nationwide organization. It's the largest donation provided by a single individual, according to the charity. I was euphoric, downright gleeful when I received the news. I've never gushed like that on the phone call, said Pat Sukum. Our gratitude is through the roof. What a remarkable example of giving to inspire even greater philanthropy to our community, passion, and our mission. Once again, Mackenzie Scott has all this money, not building a rocket that's shaped inappropriately, to go into space to pat their own ego, giving it to the needy and helping out a lot of people. Since last summer, Scott donated $48 million to six other Minnesota groups, which included $13.5 million donation to the Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity. According to the release, Scott has donated over $12 billion to more than 1,250 nonprofits since 2019. The vast majority of her donations have gone to organizations that support equity and the needs of underrepresented people. Like almost all of Scott's donations, the contribution is unrestricted, making it so the respective nonprofits can use it for programs, operations, or any purpose they deem necessary. So that's we need more of that on this planet, and far less of the other news we have today. That is for sure. We'll take a break from this. You're kind enough to join us, Patrick Cooligan. This is an interview you recorded. A lot of things going on including we do have a primary down in Minnesota 1 tonight,
yes,
which we haven't even gotten to talk about yet. I'll try to get to that here a little bit later on. But what else are you going to be talking with Patrick?
Yeah, we'll be talking about that primary. And as you said, we did record this before that shooting took place. Otherwise, we certainly would have covered that. But yeah, we're talking about the CD1 primary, the end of the legislative session, and then Eric Mortensen claiming he was banned by Delta and not having any proof that he was, even though he was fundraising.
He was. That was his big thing. It's like, look, they banned me. I need to go
He said, send me $12.86 since I was on flight 1286. Ugh.
So there's not that. We don't know if that actually happened.
Yeah. Wow. He's not providing any proof. He was chased down by Dina Winter this morning. He didn't provide an answer. Delta won't even confirm either whether he was banned or not, so Delta won't say. So I think he might not have been banned. We don't know for sure, but hopefully he can have that proof. I would think that he would want to frame that picture if he were banned, or frame that letter he got from Delta if he were banned, because that would be a big reward for him. But
I'll put 20 on Dina Winter. For sure. Brett Johnson with Patrick Cooligan from Minnesota Reformer right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon. Well, now we're back to our usual Tuesday interview with Patrick Cooligan. He is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. After last week doing a Wednesday interview, we are indeed back on Tuesdays. And there is no shortage of news to talk about today, as the end of the legislative session has come and gone. But could there be a special session? Plus, CD1 is having their primary in their special election to replace the late Jim Hagedorn, among the big political stories in the news today that we'll be talking about. Patrick, thanks so much for joining me on the show today. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. So let's start off with the end of the legislative session, as lawmakers did recently blow past a midnight deadline, failing to pass new spending for public safety, schools, health and human services, tax cuts, and other projects. But because the legislature did pass a two-year budget last year, we won't be facing a shutdown or anything like that. But with the big surplus we have right now in the state. Lawmakers were hoping to spend some of that money and give some of it back as tax cuts, but for the most part, nothing really happening as of yet unless we get a possible special session. So, Patrick, what are some of the main sticking points that we saw between Republicans and Democrats in the final hour negotiations? I understand certainly public safety was a big concern along with education.
Yeah, those were the two big subject areas where the Republican-controlled Senate and the DFL House could not come to agreement. I think that there is an underlying political factor here, and that is that Republicans sense that they could have full control of the legislature next year, and who knows, maybe even the governor's office. And so their thinking is, why cut a deal and give our opponents and their allies and the teachers union and so forth in cash infusion when we can just wait, win the legislature in the election, and then we'll have all this money next year with which to give out permanent tax cuts. And so I think that's the political calculus on the Republican, on the part of the Republicans. Has made them a lot less eager to cut a deal. Former State Senator Scott Jensen, the country physician who is going to be their nominee for governor, said as much yesterday. He said he was urging Senate Republicans to hold off and wait for a better deal once, if and when they were to win the November election. I guess they're confident about that. That strategy certainly has some political risk to it. The governor, Tim Walz, who's running for re-election, he's got a pretty big megaphone. He can go around the state and say, look, they said we should give the money back, and we wanted to, and they just wouldn't do it. And they also don't want to put any money into schools or public safety. And so he can make that case directly to the voters, that could be effective. We'll have to see.
Yeah, I know Senate Majority Leader and for the Republicans, Jeremy Miller seems pretty cool to the idea of a special session, but Walz can still certainly call one of these things and I suppose put Republicans in a tough position saying, well, here we are, I want to pass something, the DFL-controlled House wants to pass something, but the Republicans don't. So technically, Walz could still call a special session, which would be an interesting political strategy, and then just say, well, Republicans are doing nothing, kind of going to your point, saying that he can take advantage of having that big megaphone saying, we want to give you money to help with things like inflation, but Republicans said no. So have we heard any indications on whether Walz would even call a special session, even if Republicans don't necessarily want to?
Well, the problem with that strategy is that once he calls a special session, then they really have more power because they're the only ones who can adjourn it. He cannot adjourn it. Mm. So once they're in session, it's a bit of a can of worms, and it's really not, it's generally in my experience with governors, they prefer when the legislature's not in session, because then they get to control the story. And you just never know what they're going to do. Like, for instance, the state Senate, I don't think they would do this. I don't think it would be in their long-term political interest, but they could certainly sack more of his commissioners. They could craft all kinds of legislation that's just purely intended as a for the election, force Democrats into tough votes. So I don't think that is something that they would do. It would certainly be a high stakes play on his part, though.
Yeah, that's a good point. Republicans certainly do hold that card where they can still remove commissioners, even though that would be a risky strategy. It is something that they could play. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the coming days and weeks if they do end up calling a special session, if they can get Republicans somewhat on board, or as you said, and I tend to agree with your idea that Republicans probably want to use this as a strategy where they can head into next year and say we have $8 or $10 billion to use as tax cuts on a permanent basis to, well, people that are typically part of their base or the very, very wealthy who they do love giving tax cuts to. So we'll have to follow along and see if a special session does indeed materialize. are speaking with Patrick Houlihan, editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer, latest in Minnesota news and politics. Make sure you go over to MinnesotaReformer.com. Want to move on to a big primary race that is happening now in southern Minnesota, as voters in the 1st Congressional District, which encompasses large areas of southern Minnesota, are going to the polls to nominate candidates running in the 1st Congressional District special election to replace the late Jim Hagedorn. Kind of confusing, since the actual election is August 9th. Today is the primary, but on August 9th, in conjunction with the special election, it will also be the primary for November's election, which would be the full two-year term. Hopefully you're able to keep track of that. On the Republican side, the former chair of the party, Jennifer Carnahan, who is also the wife of the late Jim Hagedorn, is running. Carnahan, of course, has all sorts of troubles that she is facing, with allegations of bullying, harassment, and creating a toxic work environment while being in charge of the Republican Party. She was also, of course, affiliated with a donor, Anton Lazaro, who faces his own charges of sexual misconduct. So I know there's a lot to unpack there on the Republican side. We'll start off talking a little bit about Carnahan, because I believe the latest we've heard now is that she has now receiving unemployment, or was receiving unemployment, after she was removed as the chair of the Republican Party. Has her campaign given any sort of response to why she was receiving that unemployment? Because I'm imagining that can't really play very well, being that that she was receiving that unemployment benefits, even though she was removed after facing all of those troubles as being chair of the party.
Yeah, so our reporter Max Esterak reports that she received unemployment and put that on her campaign finance disclosure form, or her economic disclosure form. And it is a little strange, because in my memory she was fired from her job, more or less. We can use different terminology for it, and received a severance of, I think, $38,000. So I don't think, when we think of the unemployment system, we think of a person who's been fired because they were managing a toxic workplace and are friends with an accused sexual trafficker, and then voted herself a severance. I don't think we think of that kind of person should be receiving unemployment insurance. Mm-hmm. She says, through a spokesman, that she was caring for her husband, who was at the time terminally ill, and therefore that she was eligible for unemployment insurance. So be that as it may, we've tried to reach out to the Department of Employment and Economic Development to get some clarity on how she would meet eligibility, or how people in general meet eligibility, and haven't heard back from them. But it's certainly kind of a really interesting late in the race wrinkle, and just adds to that really pile of baggage that she brought into this race.
Well, this race is just wild on the Republican side, because recently Carnahan called on one of her opponents in the race, Jeremy Munson, to get out of the race following revelations that he's connected to a political consultant who's been charged with rape. And that's despite the fact that Jeremy Munson received donations from Jim Hagedorn's sister after the family of Hagedorn sued Jennifer Carnahan, claiming she hadn't reimbursed them for money used towards Jim's medical expenses. This is really an interesting race, some bad blood as we're seeing now between Carnahan and Jeremy Munson. We also, of course, have another Republican running in the first district, Brad Finstad, who has been endorsed by Pete Stauber and Michelle Fischbach. So do you have any thoughts on what we should be watching for tonight in this race for the Republicans? Because we do have three candidates running right now who all have their own challenges that they seem to be facing in this race.
Right. I mean, frankly, a dumpster fire, especially between Carnahan and Munson. I mean, and just to review, Carnahan and apparently her late husband, Jim Hagedorn, borrowed money from the mother and stepfather and the sister for cancer treatments after the Mayo Clinic had said that he was out of options. They borrowed this money, and then they've sued Carnahan and said she didn't pay us back, which really, I think, speaks to some significant family drama. Another sister has given money to Munson, as you said. Munson has hired this political consultant who is I've reported he's been charged with rape and Munson then denied that he had any connection to this guy, which turned out to be false. So yeah, those two have quite a lot going on. Finstad, I think, wants to coast in as a kind of boring, you know, conventional Republican who has the establishment behind him. And you mentioned those two key endorsements that signal that support from Stauber and Fischbach. So I talked to in an exchange I had with a Republican operative today. I think he stated the obvious. He's hoping for Finstad because I think either Munson, but especially Carnahan, it's an opportunity for the DFL to pick up a congressional seat that they probably have no business having. Just the strange circumstances have made it a possibility on that August 9th election, which, as you mentioned, it's confusing because it's also the primary day. So quite some political theater down in southern Minnesota.
And should mention before we move on the Democratic side, Richard Painter is running against Hormel Foods Corporation CEO Jeff Ettinger. Ettinger has significantly outraised Painter, so you would think he would probably be in the favorite in that race, but we'll have to see as the results come in. But he potentially could make a tough challenger for whoever comes out of the Republican primary. Either Ettinger or Painter could make, I should say, a tough challenger for the Republicans in the general election. All right, final story I got to talk to you about, Patrick. This is another wild one that has to do with Eric Mortensen, who I guess used to be a Republican, got kicked out of the caucus, but either way, he's definitely on the far right side of the spectrum. And the story with him is that he says he was banned from Delta Airlines for refusing to wear a mask on April 18th, right after a federal judge in Florida struck down the mask mandate. Now, Mortensen said he was permanently banned from Delta, and he sent out a fundraiser saying leftists were on a power trip at Delta. He said that people should honor him by sending him $12.86 in honor of the flight he was on, Flight 1286, coincidentally. But the question was he actually banned from Delta? Well, Diener Winter has been trying to find out, but unfortunately to no avail. And you and I were talking a little bit before we jumped on air. She certainly had an interesting time trying to chase him down to get an answer. And it sounds like he basically said that the reformer hates him and called him racist. So this is quite the sideshow we're seeing with Eric Mortensen right now. Do you believe his claims that you guys hate him and called him racist?
No, we have a long, and fruitful relationship with, Representative Mortensen. So, I can't believe he thinks that we would think that about him. We've certainly never called him racist. We try not to have hate in our hearts for anyone. It was just a simple, inquiry because he was, kind of bragging to his supporters that he'd been banned from Delta. And I mean, you know, never lets a fundraising opportunity pass him by. And so then it just raised the question, well, was he really banned? Because I was a little skeptical. And so then we start to try to find out, and it seems like he should have received an email or a letter. That's what happens when you get banned, by the leftists at Delta. And I'm being extremely sarcastic because there are no leftists at Delta, I'm pretty sure. But when Dina confronted about this in the hallway of the Capitol, and then another time, he doesn't want to talk about it. So for all the listeners out there, if and when you see Representative Mortensen on a Delta flight, please let us know.
Yeah, we'll know that ban didn't happen. And I would imagine if he did get banned, he would probably want to like frame this thing and show it off to all of his constituents and those that support him. But that's really cynical to be, at least this is my thought. This is only me talking, not you. I'm probably not buying that he was really banned, but that is cynical to go out and try to raise money off of the fact that you were banned, even though that might not have happened. Yeah, it's just an ugly situation and, where we are right now. But glad you guys are trying to track down whether he was actually banned. And as you said, we'll have to keep an eye out if we see Mortensen on a Delta Airlines flight in the near future. Well, we are just about out of time, unfortunately. Yeah. Oh, go ahead. Yeah, yeah.
How I was just going to say, I mean, it's funny, the whole situation, but then on the other hand, you think about it, like, you come back to Earth, okay, this guy has been trying to get everybody to not take the vaccine and not wear masks, and hundreds of thousands of people died as a result of Americans' failure to get vaccinated. So, I mean, it is a serious business, and but you just have to laugh, I guess, to get through it.
Yeah, no, I'm with you right there. Yeah, when he's been touting all of these things, talking about how vaccines don't work and face masks don't work and they're tyranny, and yeah, totally get that, absolutely. Well, we are just about out of time, unfortunately. We have been speaking with Patrick Houlihan, editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. Make sure you follow them along over at minnesotareformer.com for the latest news and politics. Patrick, as always, thanks so much for the time today. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
And let's take a break and send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show, 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Once again, the main story today, a teacher and 14 students were killed in a mass shooting in a school in Uvalde, Texas on Tuesday. Salvador Ramos, an 18-year-old Uvalde resident, so he was a resident of the town, shot and killed horrifically and incomprehensibly more than a dozen children and a teacher. Ramos is also dead, said Abbott, apparently killed by officers at the scene. A 66-year-old woman and a 10-year-old girl were critically conditioned after shooting at Robin Elementary School. Basically, the reports are coming in that quite a few kids were injured as well in this. Uvalde Memorial Hospital said shortly before 3 p.m. local time, it had received 13 children via an ambulance and buses for treatment. Two people were dead, and then they arrived at the hospital. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton has basically gone back to the armed teachers argument that, see, this would never happen if we just armed teachers. The Uvalde School District, the school where this happened at, is 90% Latino. And once again, parents had been kept away from picking up children as they were trying to sort through what exactly had happened. Yeah. And once again, they're already saying, more guns! They're already saying it. More guns. Already. I mean, what does Ken Paxton think schools should look like? That the kind of like working a celebrity through a crowd where you have people with body armor and guns taking kids off of buses, escorting them into schools, a teacher in a classroom, like I said, with night vision goggles on, you know, working the room back and forth as they try to teach about math, basically, in case a kid starts to do something that's a little questionable. Safety off, round in the chamber, safety off, finger on the trigger. Does he really think that when all of a sudden someone starts shooting up a school, that an elementary school teacher is going to be able to get down as children are screaming, bleeding, dying around them, is somehow quickly going to be able to whip out that gun, get into a shooter's position, and take them out? Is that really how they think this is going to happen? When the solutions you have are even more ludicrous than anything you've said before as regards to solutions, it just tells you there's no path to basically safety through their mentality. There is no path to safety through the Republican mentality. They will kill every damn kid in this country. They will kill every damn, and they'll still sit there and the gunmen will kill every kid in this country, and the Republicans will still sit there and say, yep, this is what the founding fathers wanted. It's a shame, but you know, it's the price of freedom. They will actually say that. If crazed gunmen kill every child in this country, they will do nothing to stop it. Nothing at all. Please. They're, like I said, they already sent Ken Paxton out there to talk about how more guns are needed. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. I'll update that story once again here in just a little bit. Let's get to the other stories that are going on. Obviously, the one that Brett and Patrick Coulian talked about is the primary down in Minnesota's 1st Congressional District. That is going on today. Now, reminder, this is the primary for the special election. The special election actually takes place on the primary in August. There was just enough time to get this primary in, and then the actual, you know, an election to basically replace Jim Hagedorn. The actual Minnesota first race will have a primary that same day for November, and then that they'll have another election coming up in November for Minnesota one. Most of the suspense for the Minnesota first race seems to be on the Republican side. Republican U.S. Representative Jim Hagedorn died of cancer in February. Special election to fill his seat got a Republican-leaning district scheduled for August 9th. Once again, though, I mean, people are saying, oh, yeah, this is a slam-dunk GOP district. Is it? It was a one-point win 1 year. It was 3 points the next year. I don't know if this is necessarily slam-dunk. And if you haven't seen, one party is for storming the U.S. Capitol against Roe v. Wade and is not going to do anything, even though we've just had another gun slaughter of children in this country. They're not going to do a damn thing. I don't think that's a slam dunk. I don't. Hagedorn's widow, Jennifer Carnahan, has been making the most overt appeals to Trump supporters. She was state chair of the Republican Party until being forced out last August after a prominent donor was indicted on sex trafficking charges. Well, and then there was her incompetent leadership of the Minnesota GOP. Next up on the hit parade, Senator State Representative Jeremy Munson, a founder of the hard right faction that broke from the main Minnesota House GOP caucus, has been endorsed by U.S. Senators Ted Cruz and Rand Paul of Kentucky. I got to tell you the truth. He's my favorite candidate because I just don't think they can hold that seat if Munson's the winner. He's out there putting a Jensen thing out there and talking about how it's rocks and cows territory. He's like, oh, okay. All righty, appealing to that far-right extremist. And he won't, and the best part of all for the DFL is he won't moderate his stance. He will stay this far-right loon ball the entire election, and, you know, fine. Former State Representative Brad Finstad is the backing of several Minnesota GOP office holders. He's reminded voters he was Trump's Minnesota director of the USDA Rural Development. On the Democratic side, the candidate endorsed by the party's district convention earlier this month is former Hormel Foods CEO Jeff Ettinger. His opponents include University of Minnesota law professor Richard Painter, a former White House ethics lawyer for George W. Bush. I interviewed all three Democratic candidates that are running in the special election. I interviewed all three. They're all part of Democrat of the Day. They're all up on SoundCloud. If you do want to hear them before you vote down, if you're down in the one, you want to hear them, by all means, go to SoundCloud, go to iTunes, type in Democrat of the Day. You can type in any of the candidates. They should pop up there with AM 950 or Matt McNeil Show. And bonjour. Enjoy. There you go. I think Ettinger is looking like the solid favorite. I don't know. Painter, someone told me that Painter is doing better, but I thought the last time I saw the numbers, it was pretty much Ettinger's on his side there. And Jeffrey Ettinger, as the former CEO of Hormel Foods, is a very difficult candidate for the Republicans to take down. He's going to be a very difficult candidate. I mean, you got to imagine there's going to be a lot of communities, especially on the eastern side of the state, that are going to, you know, yeah, well, okay, I'm going to go with the guy that ran the company and ran the company pretty well when he was down there. So there's that story I want to make sure I mention. Also, I want to make sure I get into the Minnesota coronavirus update for today. The COVID-19 update from the Minnesota Department of Health includes 4,033 newly reported cases, 5 reported deaths. The state's COVID-19 death toll now 12,601. Today's update includes case data from the 72-hour period ending at 4 a.m. on Monday. So that's 3 days worth. That's actually a little down on the average day there. Through May 23rd, the number of people with COVID-19 hospitalized in Minnesota was 416, down from 422. Reported on May 20th, of those hospitalized, 28 people are in intensive care, down from 36. 388 are in non-ICU care. That's up from 386. As of May 22nd, the state reported that 3,914,320 people have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. 3,709,309 people have completed their vaccine series. And there are 2,551,028 Minnesotans up to date with all their boosters. Total number of people who have been sick in the state of Minnesota, and this should probably flip over tomorrow, is 1,499,038 people. So we are going to be over 1,500,000 sick of COVID in the state of Minnesota. And a reminder, that number is grossly undercounted, The amount of home tests and stuff like that. Yeah. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention on Monday said it's likely the United States will see additional cases of monkeypox in the coming weeks. But officials caution that it's harder to transmit the virus than it is to spread the respiratory illnesses like COVID-19. Monkeypox, which comes from spreading throughout Europe, has an incubation period of 1 to 2 weeks, often comes with flu-like symptoms, swollen lymph nodes, a rash, and lesions. Most people recover from the virus within 2 to 4 weeks without specific treatment, although it can be more severe for those with immune compromise or have other illnesses. Lab tests have confirmed one case in Massachusetts, man. The CDC is waiting on lab results to confirm what officials suspect is a case in Florida, one in New York, and two in Utah. What I find to be interesting about the story is apparently this all got started because of, and I'm not making this up, people having sex at raves in Europe. Now, yeah, I find that to be interesting that the way that this is being passed on to people is through sex at raves. It's a kind of a sexually transmitted disease at this point. And so, yeah, I think you gotta be pretty careful here at this point. And I don't know how they're tracking this down, but I don't think it's going to be that. It's not like COVID, where as a respiratory disease, how many people were in the office? How many people were on the airplane? How many people were in your house? That sort of thing. It's like, well, who did you have sex with? You know, it kind of gets, unless this has hit the porn industry, or OnlyFans, I don't think it's going to necessarily be the harder thing to track for sure. All the cases the CDC is investigating on Monday afternoon were travel associated and have occurred in men, according to Jennifer McQuiston, deputy director of the CDC's Division of High Consequence Pathogens and Pathology. Despite the higher than normal spread of monkeypox in the United States and Europe, she said public health officials have no reason to believe the virus has become more easily transmittable. Right now, we're not seeing any evidence the virus has changed, become more efficiently transmitted person to person. She also noted that researchers had done decades of study on monkeypox to learn how it spreads and how to treat it, a much different situation than officials faced with COVID-19, which was they were trying to learn on the fly. Doses of two vaccines approved by treatment of smallpox can be used for monkeypox are stored in the Strategic National Stockpile. The CDC says monkeypox was first discovered in 1958 when two outbreaks of a pox-like disease occurred in colonies of monkeys kept for research, hence the name monkeypox. John Brooks, a medical epidemiologist of the CDC's Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention, said on the call with reporters that monkeypox spreads through close personal contact. It's not traditionally thought of as a sexually transmitted disease, but it can be spread through sexual contact. Brooks noted that while anyone can develop and spread monkeypox, many of the people diagnosed so far in the U.S. identify as gay or bisexual men, and the virus appears to be circulating globally in parts of the gay community. Anyone who has new or unexplained rash, Brooks said, should see a doctor and make sure mentioned to the healthcare provider that monkeypox is being observed in the United States and other parts of the world. The rash can look similar to chickenpox or herpes, he added. So, yeah, be careful. And do we really actually have to put out a warning about, large sex parties in Europe as not the best idea? That's probably not where you want to go. Okay. So, but once again, treatable. They have vaccines that can work on this. They got medications that work on this. For most people, it's, 2 to 4 weeks. And just, if you've got a rash, that's starting to show up, immediately go talk to a doctor. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Another thing, if I can just say really quick, it's a good thing that most hospitals and medical facilities are still on COVID protocol, because that will help as well limit the amount of spread of this in within society, I think. That's a good thing, too. We'll take a break. Come on back. I'll wrap up the story of the day in Texas. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. We'll run through once again the story that we're following today. 14 children dead and a teacher as well, along with the gunman, opened fire at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas. The school contained children aged 7 to 10. Police officers believed to have killed the 18-year-old gunman. The White House on Tuesday said that President Biden had spoke with Governor Greg Abbott, offering him any assistance that he needed. In a statement, the National Parents Union called for policy change and more than thoughts and prayers, citing more than 100 school shootings in Texas since 1970. 100 school shootings in Texas alone since 1970. Wow. As a nation, our track record of putting children before politics, before special interest, is shameful and leaves us with little hope, the organization said. Please prove us wrong. Senator Susan Collins, a Republican of Maine, described the attack as an unbelievable, tragic, and horrible crime and expressed support for so-called red flag laws that help restrict potentially violent individuals from accessing firearms. Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, a Democrat whose effort at legislation on background checks for gun purchases was blocked in 2013, said it makes no sense at all why we can't do common sense things to try to prevent some of this from happening. The massacre at Robb Elementary School comes as the trial is underway for the gunman for the 2018 shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, where a former student killed 17 people, injured 17 others in one of the deadliest school shootings in American history. Ryan Ramirez could not find his daughter, a fourth grader at Robb Elementary. When he showed up at the school and at a reunification point at the Civic Center, nobody's telling me anything, he told KSAT in San Antonio. I'm trying to find out where my baby is at. Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, tweeted the shooting has left him horrified and heartbroken. His spokesman said the senator has no further comment. My guess is he's waiting to hear from the NRA on what he should say. The shooting at the elementary school in Texas comes just 10 days after a gunman killed 10 people, all of whom were black, at a Buffalo grocery store. It's being reported the subject shot his grandmother right before he went into the school. Greg Abbott of Texas said Abbott also said he'd been reported that the gunman had been a student at Uvalde High School in Uvalde, Texas. Gavin Newsom, governor of California, a Democrat who's called for stringent laws on gun safety, criticized Republicans. Another shooting, he tweeted, and the GOP won't do a damn thing about it. Where the hell are we if we cannot keep our kids safe? Exactly. And once again, the NRA is scheduled to have a meeting in Houston, their annual meeting in Houston, starting on Friday. Seven 10-year-olds. An assault weapon, guns were used on 7 to 10-year-olds. 14 of them are dead. We have no idea how many of them are injured. I'm getting the impression that number is going to be over 20. These are kids who, like I said, were thinking about going swimming, playing Minecraft, watching SpongeBob. And now they're dead. Because, frankly, we have political leaders in this country who the money from the NRA is more important than the lives of your children. It's just that simple. The money that they get from the NRA is far more important than the lives of children in this country. And a reminder, as we talk about this, the Republican Party is the one out there claiming that Roe v. Wade needs to be overturned because they are there to protect life. They ban books because they want to keep safe. They kids safe, they say. They ban masks because they want to keep kids safe. They ban transgender athletes because they want to try to keep kids safe. And the reality is the one thing they could do to really keep kids safe is ban guns, and they will not do it. We're back tomorrow. Until then, see ya.